What's the most important resource that you have? If you really thought about this deeply, I think you'd come to the same conclusion that Joey and I did. It's time. In our newest book, What's Without Wall Street, The 3 Steps to Financial Freedom Through Passive Income, we talk about how are we tracking that time? What is the thing that we can do to get more of that time back?
That's right. If you've ever been listening to our podcast and thought, man, it would be amazing if I could take all the things that you guys have learned over the last 10 years and just summarize them, put them in some way to easily digest them and take action, that's what this book is all about. You're not going to want to miss it. Go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/new book and get your copy today.
Welcome. This is the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Your host, Joey, the Italian Stallion Mure, joined as always by Russ, the idea guy, Morgan. All right, Russ. I'm driving down the road. I am tuned into Wealth Without Wall Street because I have to figure out how to create cash flow. Why do you think people are thinking that right now?
Well, I think because we have so many things pulling at us. We have jobs, we have kids, we have the kids' activities. There is an endless amount of things that we need to do. But in the back of our mind, we're like, we got to create this passive income that Joey and Russ keeps talking about. And I don't know exactly how to do that. I got some money, but I don't necessarily have the time to research every stinking thing or go do everything they're telling me about.
Well, I know that I can't keep doing the same things I've always done and expect a different result. I need something fresh. I need something new. I need something outside of the box. Wall Street is the box. I got to get outside of that.
You got to get outside of it. Joey, I was on a call today and one of our clients said, I've got to stop listening to you guys' podcast because I'm in the process of doing 3 different businesses that you guys have been teaching just on this, in the last like 2 months. You guys have to stop. And I get that. I understand that the need and the pull to create cash flow so that we can actually achieve those financial goals we've set for ourselves is so important. And I think it's good, Joey, that we have episodes like today, is that if this is the path that we choose, because remember our 4-step process, get clarity, take control, pick your course or your path, and then start creating a life that you really want to live, right? So today we're going to show you a path. And this path is not for everybody, but it is one that can create cash flow. And I think that's an answer to a lot of questions we've been having lately coming from you as a listener.
Well, and how many of you right now are saying, I really want a deal that I can share around the water cooler that nobody else knows about? If you're thinking that right now, tune in, okay? This guy, Scott Krohn, is our guest today. He has created something. How many people have we interviewed, Russ? Over 150 people. Yeah. And this is the first time this subject matter has even come up to us.
Well, the concept of how he created cash flow, we've actually interviewed a few people that have done this model, but the creativity in which he does it is new. We've never heard of that before. And I love the fact that he actually has an architect's background, started working with a development company, and then figured out that there was a need, and he figured out a way to solve the problem through that need. So let's don't spend any more time on this. Let's jump into this interview with Scott Krohn from the Coda Management Group.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now, here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Mure.
Welcome into the show. We have Scott Krohn as our guest today. Scott, man, thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to this. Thank you very much for having me.
Scott, the interesting thing I've
already learned about you is that not only do you guys crush the self-storage space and have been doing it for quite a while, but you give people like myself even an opportunity to get involved from an active standpoint. So I'm excited to kind of find out a lot of these different details. We're going to go through many different things, but just for those who don't know much about you and your company, CODA, C-O-D-A, how did you guys get started in the self-storage space? And give us a little bit of your background.
Well, my background is in multifamily development. When I was getting my master's in architecture, my professor owned a real estate development company that also did architecture and contracting. And my master's thesis was a 400 unit development that he was working on. So he'd have us work in class. And then when I was not in class, I was then working in his office. So from basically like 7 a.m. until midnight, I was working on this project for 3 years. And then when I graduated, I kept working for him.
And wait a minute. Was your grade dependent on how good that deal went? I mean, did he have like a little carrot there? Like, hey, you better.
Exactly. So it was a little bit dependent upon it for sure. But that and my future employment. So, you know, it being the TA, you know, I felt I had a good understanding of what was going on. But it was a great learning experience. So I learned in multifamily. That was a $100 million project that I worked on for 6 years. And during that time, I also worked on two other projects, ground up developments. And then we also did condo conversions from apartments into condos. So I had to understand the apartment model in order to convert it into condos. So we did three conversions and during that period of time. So I started CODA and we got into single family, mixed use and multifamily. And then the crash came and, you know, no one could get any financing for anything on the residential side. So, you know, naturally everybody began, you know, redirecting their time, their assets into multifamily because that was the only thing that banks were lending on. But then you had this huge cap compression because everyone was buying apartments. And that's where I began. I had a real estate client that was wanting to get into distressed self-storage. I couldn't find one anywhere. So that led me to start thinking like, well, why isn't it distressed in this great recession?
Right.
And that's when I began understanding, learning the model. And I always told them like, hey, look, if you really want to make money in real estate, it's on the development side. It's not just on the owning side, but there's bigger money on the development side. And we found this property that was supposed to be converted into condominiums and townhomes, and the market crashed. They couldn't get the financing. And so we converted the building back into self-storage, and that's how we began.
All right, I want to take you back because I want to get into that. I think that's the exciting part. But you said something in there, Joey. I don't know if you caught, but I know our listener did. As you said that you couldn't find a distressed self-storage space to buy. Why is that? Why is that self-storage was not also being effective like everything else?
Well, since that time, I've gone back and studied the market. And, you know, I'm old enough, and I don't know if you can't tell from the sides of gray, but even, you know, look in the back, you can definitely tell I've been old enough to be through four recessions, if whether or not we're technically in a recession right now. So the bottom line is that we went back and looked at the last four major downturns. And in each of those cases, self-storage maybe dropped 1 or 2 basis points and then rebounded 3 or 4 within a year. And so I termed it when we were presenting to our community of investors that they're recessionary resistant. And that was a position that I made to them because a lot of people are saying self-storage is recessionary proof.
Right.
I'm not as comfortable with that, you know, because there can be a slight downtick, but then overwhelmingly it rebounds very fast and aggressively compared to the rest of the marketplace. And when we really studied and got into the depth of this, there's the four D's, which is displacement, death, divorce, and I'm missing one right now, but I apologize. But basically, people are going through major changes in their life, and they don't want to have to give up stuff. It's painful, right? I mean, you're going through a traumatic time, and you don't want to have to give up stuff. And so it's easier to put it into self-storage and then address the problem later on. Or when things get settled down, your life normalizes a little bit. I mean, I bet everybody can appreciate right now what normal life really is. But, you know, we're all seeking to get back to the new normal or normal. But once that new normal arrives, then I can address which stuff I need to keep, which stuff I can, you know, can emotionally give up those sorts of things.
So it's kind of like a placeholder, no pun intended. I mean, you're literally, it's in between those transitions. You have to have somewhere to keep the stuff, unless you just literally liquidate the entire thing immediately, which hardly ever happens, right?
Hardly ever happens.
Well, and at the end of the day, I mean, you see it. I mean, people are going to at least go to self-storage, whether or not they ever come back and pick it up. And we've all seen the storage war shows and stuff like that. Those things exist, but they start there, and it's become, from what I understand, a very cash flow positive machine. You guys have been doing this space for quite a while now. You mentioned since 2013. So talk to us about the cash flow, because our listener is looking for a path out of either their current role that they're in at their job, or they're looking for the security blanket to help them know that, hey, I can go and try my next business venture knowing that I've got this safety net of cash flow coming in that's equal to or greater than my monthly expenses. How does self-storage play into that? And what are some of the examples you could kind of share with us?
Well, there's really three asset classes within self-storage. And part of the important thing is when you're defining which of these asset classes you want to go into is based upon what sort of economic returns, what sort of your investment goals are. So the first is Class C. And when we say Class C, that doesn't mean like it's in a bad neighborhood. It just means it's first generation self-storage, not climate control, probably more out in the country rather than in an urban market. And we equate that to a penny stock. So it's going to have a consistent yield, not a huge yield, but it's going to be a consistent cash flowing machine. We have friends that operate theirs literally on a flip phone. And you know, their predominant attitude is, I don't like people. I don't want to deal with people. So they can call my flip phone and I'll have the locker ready for them, and I don't want to ever deal with them. I mean, that is as simplistic as the model can possibly get, right?
Right.
Class B is that version, newer, closer to the urban markets, and might be climate controlled. So you're dealing more in suburban rather than rural, but it's predominantly still drive up. And that is like a blue chip stock. It will do well in a good or bad economy and just have a consistent yield. It will just be like a cash machine. Then the Class A is what we're dealing with, is when in urban areas where there's new facilities where you're actually driving into the facilities, they're all climate controlled. So you're dry, safe, and secure when you're unloading it. And it's either in a new building or a rehabilitated building. And all of it is enclosed inside the existing structure. And that's where we say that's like a growth stock. You're going to get appreciation as well as cash flow.
Which, okay, so that brings us to the idea you said that kind of spurred you on, was rehabilitating a space that was going to be turned into condos. Is that what you said?
Right.
But then you actually turned it into self-storage?
Correct.
Okay, I'm having a hard time even visualizing what that looks like. Could you explain maybe how that deal looked?
Sure. Well, I'll take one that we're doing more recently because I think it'll be easier to visualize. We're doing one in Dayton right now. And with my background of multifamily, we began designing every multifamily building based upon the parking. So the underground garage would be based upon the parking structure in terms of the bays. The width of the bays would be based upon two different parking spaces. The depth of the bay would be based on a car. The driving alley would be the next column bay, and then you have another parking. So the whole unit density was based upon how many cars we could get into the basement in order to accommodate the parking loads. So we literally designed the building from the basement up rather than from the top down. So this building in Dayton, the column layout couldn't accommodate parking at all because it was so irregular that there was no efficiencies within the parking. Your driving aisle was too narrow. Your parking bays were too wide, so you couldn't get two cars in there. It was like you'd only get one. And so it just didn't work. So they could never put condominiums in that building because they didn't have any extra parking. They didn't have any other land for parking. So if they couldn't get it in the building, then there was no way to have apartments. So the building was sitting vacant and empty. And that's where we came in. And, you know, we need four parking spaces.
Right.
You know, and two of them we can drive into the building. So it's like we just need two outside. So we could accommodate that. So we were easily able to convert the building into self-storage. It was zoned for self-storage. We didn't have to ask for a zoning variation. And as a result of it, we could convert the entire building into self-storage versus apartments.
Wait, so what was it before you bought it? What was it being used for?
It was empty.
It was going to be an apartment complex or condominium, but
was poorly planned.
They poorly planned the parking. They couldn't make it work. Is that what you said?
They bought it. They went under contract for it. The building had been vacant for a long time. The developer went under and tried to see if they had other options for parking. And when they couldn't get it, then they decided that we're either going to sell it or we're going to have to come up with a different use. And so that's when we bought it.
So what your company does, if I understand this right, is that you guys give people an option to kind of come in, either bring a space to you and you guys then evaluate, and I want to understand what that looks like, or secondly, come apart as a partner with you guys if you guys already find deals and they could participate that way. Did I get that right? If not, please clarify for me.
Yeah, and one of the things I'd like to offer your listeners here is if someone has a piece of property or a building that they think is good for self-storage, if they email us, and I think you have a link that you can connect us to them, and they mention this show, we will do a free evaluation. We're not going to steal anyone's property, or we'll sign a non-compete, non-circumvent if that's what, this world is too small for us to try to be stealing properties that way. That's not our goal. So if someone comes to us and say, hey, is this a good deal? We'll first help them evaluate whether or not the property is good for self-storage. And, we look at density, we look at population, we look at market saturation, we look at economics, we look at zoning. We'll look at a bunch of different things to determine whether or not it's even viable to go forward with it. And then the second thing that we have is when we identify a property, then we have investors come alongside us that participate in our deals.
All right. So if you want to, if you do have a property in mind, Jay, I'm thinking of a couple right now, and you want to reach out to Scott and his team, it's wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/CODA. That's CODA. And we'll have the link available to it. Also, and Scott's going to be coming back next week and giving us time to kind of see what all that even looks like and doing a live Q&A. So I think you'll want to participate in that as well.
Yeah. So walk us through just the very first opportunity where when someone comes to you, they're hiring you essentially as like a consultant to tell them the viability of the project. And then do you also help them with, are there options for financing and things like that? Or do you just stop at just evaluating the project?
No, I mean, we can structure the deal however they would like to do it. So when I say the deal, structure the deal. If they want to hire us just to do a feasibility of the property and determine, great. If they want to hire us to do it from A to Z, nuts to bolts, we can do that too. I mean, we just did a similar concept with a church. The church came to us and said, hey, we have no idea what we're doing about real estate. We're good at church things, but we're not good at real estate things. So can you help us with the real estate things? And the first thing I said to him is, you got to stop thinking like a church, start thinking like a real estate person. And, I'll try to start thinking more like a faith person and trust more. So we'll blend. And so we helped them identify the property. We got them the zoning. We designed it. We put them in contact with a lender and we built it and we structured the whole deal for them, from land acquisition to zoning, working with the title company, the closing, the design, the building permits, and the build final inspections until they moved in.
Today's content is so awesome, man. I just wanted to make sure you knew that there's access to the Q&A from today's episode at wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/community.
Yeah, you need to be a part of this movement if these are the types of things you want to learn about and be surrounded by over 3,000 other people on the same journey. Let's get back to the episode.
Well, from an architect perspective, you kind of have that mindset too. You know what opportunities there are in a structure and which ones they're not. I think that has to come in really valuable when you're consulting.
Well, it is huge, not just consulting, but when we're looking at a building together for our own team, we have to hire a local architect of record, because whatever state we're in, we have to have an architect of record in that state. We like to hire someone in that city that has a relationship with the municipality. And so in our Dayton deal, the local architect, he's now going to begin working for a developer. He's like, man, it's totally different on this side of the table. I'm like, yes. I mean, you realize that every decision has this financial implication. But if I'm going into it as a developer and I have the view of an architect, then I can figure out what is going to be the most economical design that accomplishes our goal versus having all these other things that will add cost, or, you know, how to avoid pitfalls because of the fact that we, you know, if you don't understand the repercussions of what you're looking and considering.
Okay. Before we move on, my head is just completely stuck on this picture of people driving to church in a U-Haul and then like dumping their stuff in their storage bin before they go sit at the pew. Like, help me. I mean, is that what's going on in this project? I mean,
yeah, exactly. You get blessed first and then you move right on in, you know?
I'm serious though. Like, what does that project look like?
Well, the one we're doing in Louisville is not too far fetched from that one. We are working with a local church, and it will be a flex warehouse space, flex storage space. So it could be the first and only self-storage church and bar building ever. So, you know, it's we're buying 145,000 square feet, and it's just too much square footage for self-storage. But the building's very dividable. So we're going to have the back half of the building being self-storage, and then we have these existing tenants in there that we're going to move into the front half of the building. So we'll have flex warehouse space, and then we'll have self-storage. And one of the possible tenants that we're working with is a local church that wants to use the building as a means of facilitating ministry within the community. So we literally could have the model that you're talking about.
I love this. I mean, I'm all over this.
All right. So you mentioned there's two types of deals that you guys work in. We just kind of covered the self deal, right? The idea that I have a place and I bring it to you, and maybe you tell me it's a great idea. Joey never tells me my ideas are great. So that you have a chance to really go up in my book over Joey. The second type of deal is more of a done for you model. That's where you guys have already identified a project. You're looking for investors and partners to come into it. Let's talk about what that looks like.
Well, we approach it the same. You know, we're going to put the same lens and the same criteria on it. So we're not going to tell someone like, hey, this is a bad deal for us, but you should go ahead and do it. You know, it has to make sense from an overall economic point of view, first and foremost. It's just whether or not we feel that that's an area that we want to put our resources towards. And, you know, that's a judgment call. Everybody has their own criteria. If we're doing a development deal, we're always looking at what is the underlying economic principles that are behind it. What are the fundamentals? And that's one of the things that I have so much more appreciate on the self-storage side than when I was ever on the multifamily side, is the fact that how demographically driven and how data driven this whole industry is. It's very predictable, and it's very you can model it out. And so we look at saturation rates, you know, how many lockers per capita are in the marketplace. We're looking at a 3 to 5 mile radius. I mean, that's how specific our market is. We're not looking at the entire city. We're not looking at a neighborhood. We're looking at a specific 3 mile radius. And so we will study that. We will study how many renters there are, what the population is. We'll study, you know, what the medium income is, what the household income is, because that will help determine what size lockers we put in. And then we look at the zoning, and then we'll look at, you know, does the building lend itself to this use? And then on top of that, what other economic benefits that we can apply? So for instance, our project that we just opened up last week in Wisconsin, we got $1.5 million of historical tax credits. The building was deemed historical. We went through that process. And so now we're giving back our investors the equivalent of $1.5 million of historic tax credits. Other properties that we're opening up, one in Toledo this week, and then the Dayton one, and then the Louisville one, they're all in opportunity zones. And so we created the first opportunity zone that was funded. And we also had an entity called Pace Financing that helped increase the capital stack. And so we're looking at different ways in how we can enhance the capital stack. So we've sold off cell towers. We've sold, you know, we've sold historical tax credits, opportunity zones, PACE financing. These are all ways in which we can, you know, structure or enhance the capital stack for our investors' benefit.
But so even back up to like even simpler, someone wants to join you on a deal. Their only thing they're being asked for is equity. On the front end on a deal, is any portion of the project then financed through like a traditional bank? And what are those limits that you're typically looking at? How does that work?
So they are funded by banks. You know, the one in Wisconsin was an SBA. The one in Dayton is just a local Ohio bank. The one in Toledo is a credit union, a consolidation of credit unions in Toledo.
But are they like 70% loan to value, 60, 80?
Yeah, 70%. Okay. And then we'll layer in the other 30% between equity and PACE, if we can, if it's in a PACE qualified state. And within the Toledo, Dayton, and Louisville, part of that equity capital stack, we have our opportunity funds. So we created an opportunity fund, actually two of them for our investors, because we found out our properties weren't in the zones. And we said to our investors, hey, they're in a zone. Would anybody want to have the ability to invest in an opportunity fund? And the first one, three people raised their hands and they said, we'd love to do it. What's it going to cost us? And we're like, we're not going to charge you anything for it. We'll just do it for you because you're obviously already investing in our project. We're not going to use it to make money off of you. We're just going to do it to help you.
Gotcha.
And then that Christmas they came back and said, when are you opening up your next fund? We have more money. So that's how it grew.
And then do each investor get like monthly dividends, or like how does the actual structure of a deal look like? I mean, not necessarily everyone, but in general, how do they get paid back?
Well, everybody is an owner in the company. So they're a member and they have a percentage of the ownership of the company. So whenever there's a distribution of cash, they get that percentage of it. So the first thing we try to do is always return equity first. So that way they stay in the deal. Most developers buy out their partners at that point in time. We keep ours in the deal. So that's one significant difference between us and others. And so whatever, if we cash refinance, they get that percentage of it. If we have a cash distribution from cash flow, they get that percentage of it. And then when we sell, they get the same percentage.
Well, I think obviously there's just so much, Joey, in self-storage that you can get involved in. And we're seeing cash flow on both sides of the space. I love the fact that you said it's recession resistant. There was a downtick, but there in the preceding year, I see you probably see an increase, and that's probably correlated to, I mean, again, if people fall down the ladder, right? When things happen, people fall down the ladder. So you might have some people that have stuff in your storage facility and they lose their job. So then that's when you lose them as renters. But then at the same time, the group above them lose their job and they're having to downgrade or change spaces. I'm assuming probably leaving a house, maybe going to an apartment, maybe going to a trailer, something like that. And so then there's extra furniture that has to go somewhere. And that's probably the pickup that you see, because it's always the one at the bottom is usually the one impacted first. And then it's that trickle down effect. Well, Scott, I want to definitely come back to this and have more questions specifically from our listeners who are going to ask you questions of how they would get involved, right? Can they bring you a deal and then even maybe be partners with you in it? Have you had anybody do that with you guys yet?
We have. And, you know, we just looked at one recently, like I think last month, and, you know, we told them not to buy the building. You know, we would highly recommend not buying the building.
Wait a minute. So people come to you and say, this is the perfect spot for what you're saying. And you say, don't do it.
Exactly. So, it was this building that had been unimproved for 4 years or 5 years. It was permitted for self-storage and the developer didn't move forward on it. And our client was absolutely convinced that, one, that they could buy it, and two, that it was going to be the perfect building. And, you know, we looked at, you know, current pictures of it. He got in the building and showed us pictures of it. And there's water infiltration and eroding of concrete structures. And, you know, there's life forms growing up on the roof. And I mean, it was just the building. It was like the worst shaped building we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And we said, we don't care. You could get this building for free and you would still lose money. So please don't buy this building. You know,
so I gotta imagine, and maybe you can speak to this really quickly as we land the plane, but how big is this opportunity coming at us right now from a standpoint of commercial space? Seems to be, I feel like it is overbuilt and now it's starting to even
become like less and less businesses are going to take these commercial spaces. So it's going to leave a lot of vacancies. Am I right in that? Are you seeing that same trend that maybe there'll be a solution for some of these large box places that are just sitting empty and vacant right now?
Well, it's just not commercial. It's also retail. I think when people associate commercial, they think of office, and you know, there is going to be a need for that. I mean, obviously the way in which businesses are using buildings is changing dramatically. In fact, I was just on a president's symposium earlier today, and everyone was saying how the need to go back in the office has diminished dramatically. I don't think we can totally move away from the office. I'm not convinced of that. I think the tech companies that think that they got it all figured out, that because they're used to that sort of format, but so much of business is just collaboration of ideas and people being actually in dialogue and physical contact with one another. I don't think you can totally take it away. But the way in which it is changing, there's no doubt about it. And the same with retail. The hurdle is whether or not the local municipalities are going to be equally receptive. You know, even in Dayton right now, despite the fact that the building literally sat vacant for 40 years and, you know, couldn't be developed anything else and was zoned as a right for self-storage, they've been pushing against us. They've tried withholding our PACE financing. They've been doing other things in order to try to block our ability to do this as of right, which we're permitted to do. And so, you know, it's not the sexy, you know, real estate play that everyone, you know, like, oh, I'm in commercial, I'm in, you know, whatever. It's the stepchild. It's off on the side. You know, it's like the Cinderella, like, you know, you only come to the ball when we don't think you're going to go to the ball, right? And but it has the big returns. I mean, one of the things you did ask is how does it compare to multifamily? You know, when I was doing that $100 million project, that was 400 units. So 400 units for $100 million in revenue. And our cost basis was equally as high. I mean, it was, you know, staggering how much money we had to put into this building. So we can do 600, 800 apartment, like lockers for 10% of that, less than 10% of that, like 5% of that. And so for us, we can have a greater economy as a scale, flexibility of our product type, because we can alter our configurations based on the marketplace. I couldn't really alter the condominium configurations, but I could alter the locker configurations. I have a lot more flexibility. My cost to manage it is 35% compared to 55% within multifamily. And so it's a lot easier to manage because it's apartments without toilets. It's less expensive to manage, and my cost basis is a lot less. You know, I'm paying $45,000, $55,000, $65,000 per door for an apartment. We're paying like, you know, a couple of thousand dollars for a locker.
No, that totally makes sense. And then if everything goes bad, you hire a local TV group to come and broadcast the storage wars at your new facility, right? So, well, Scott, thank you for coming on the show. This is super insightful and interesting for us to kind of learn more ways that we can create passive income streams so that we get closer to our objective, which is living a life that's worth living. And I love the fact that we had a chance to kind of hear your viewpoint from it and how they can get involved in it. And again, if you want to take Scott up on either the Q&A, or if you do have a facility and you think it may be a good idea and you want to get Scott's quick opinion on it, you can go to wealthwaltwallstreet.com/CODA, that's CODA, and make sure you mention Joey and I as the one who sent you there, and Scott will give you 15 minutes to try to sell him on how good your deal is.
We'll give you a little bit more than 15 minutes, I promise.
All right, Scott, thank you so much for coming on, and look forward to having you next week on the Q&A.
Sounds good. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand, so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.